We're familiar with many Native American place names that dot the map of Wisconsin and North America, for that matter, but the influence of Native American cultures remains deeper than that. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me are Aaron Birdbear, Assistant Dean of the Student Diversity Program at the School of Education at the UW-Madison, and Daniel Einstein, Historic and Cultural Resources Manager at the UW-Madison. And a pleasure having you here, and we have literally a lot of ground to cover, but we're talking about cultural landscapes, and what, first of all, does that mean to you all when you talk about a cultural landscape?
When we talk about cultural landscapes, often there's some confusion because the term sometimes gets used to describe what the music scene looks like in your community. How many museums do you have? But this is a specific use of the term to look at the relationship of people and the land. Culture, an expression of human experience, and the land, the water, the resources, and how the land influences people's behavior and how people shape the land. So it's a very specific way of looking at our shared past.
And we can still see this if we look at the land today?
Well, cultural landscapes are all around us, obviously. There are four general types of cultural landscapes that we talk about. Designed landscapes, places that were influenced by a gardener or a landscape architect, a designer, vernacular landscapes, places where so-called ordinary people make their lives in functional domestic settings, historic sites, places where some special event occurred that is significant. And then finally, the category that we refer to as ethnographic. This is where people find expression on the landscape through their cultural or heritage affiliation. So lots of different versions of this idea, cultural landscapes.
And of course, I mean, they are all around us, but we're going to, for the sake of most of this conversation at least, we're going to focus on the area around the UW-Madison in part because it's so rich with, these landscapes, these cultural landscapes. And so can you give me, I'm sure you can, either one of you, examples of these illustrations of these four types of landscapes?
Well, on campus, an example of a designed landscape would be Henry Mall, where you have this garden space surrounded by very orderly Beaux-Arts inspired architecture. A vernacular site on campus might be the Tent Colony out towards Eagle Heights, where students and their families set up tents for over 60 years and spent the summers out there while they attended summer school. An example of a historic site would be Camp Randall Memorial Park, which commemorates the Civil War training ground. All of these places are where important interactions with the land occur. So often when we talk about historic places, people focus on buildings. Cultural landscapes can be seen as the places between the buildings, between the architecture that ties things together.
Well, if we're looking at things other than buildings in terms of cultural landscape, the first thing that would come to mind to me in this vicinity would be the remnants of the mound culture.
Yeah. Aho. Bonjour. Poso. Well, hello. I love saying hello in the languages that have been spoken here for time immemorial. And when I introduce myself, I often say poso because that's the oldest way we know how to say hello to one another as humans here in the Western Great Lakes. And so when earlier, before I get to the effigy mounds, when Daniel was describing a little bit of the historic and vernacular kind of cultural landscapes, I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a colonial veneer. that's just scratching the surface.
That's right.
You know, so when I think about how we in academia do research and design and kind of define things, I'm often thinking, man, they're only looking at the last, 1.4% of the human story here, and that 98.6% of the human story, or the humans kicking it, hashtag chilling, before 1848, their understanding and expressions and living in the land is just so different. And so when I think of the cultural landscapes and the different kind of categorizations of them today, I think about how the Ho-Chunk often describe that, people want to categorize with our European and European-American concepts of religion or spirituality, how the land is designed. And the Ho-Chunk say, we just have a way of being. This is just who we are. All our chapoticas, our lodges, our wigwams, the chapoticas, the door to each one would face east. So can you imagine if every building, the only door in Henry Mall, all doors had to face east? That's a rule, like a cultural rule, a protocol, culture in action. So when I think about the colonial veneer that we have and how we kind of express our new colonial project called the United States, and it is just an amazing project, but it's so new. And its kind of depth is a little shallow, and we're still trying to find our way together as a society, as we notice today's rhetoric, as we're trying to find out who's included and not included, and whose stories take prominence and whose don't. So I think about cultural landscapes, I just kind of think about the depth of humanity here and the many different ways of cultural expression. And the effigy mound, this great late woodland people who wanted to honor members of their society with these massive monuments, these huge earthworks, the labor to build a monument that's several hundred feet long, 624 feet long.
Yeah, that eagle.
1,300 feet long. Yeah. You know, I mean, just the incredible effort and kind of worldview that these people lived in and through to share who they were. And I think of the incredible Observatory Hill effigy mound group that we still have on our campus that was built likely about 1,000 years ago. And just remembering some just really amazing people in their society and having a ceremonial spot to return to each year. So when I think of this great cultural landscape that we have, yes, this new colonial project, which is just a fascinating settler state of people from other continents who've joined us in the Western Hemisphere. Welcome. And we're trying to figure out expressions together. But the colonial veneer is easily pulled back at UW-Madison because we have such a rich archaeological legacy to contend with. And it's hidden in plain sight for the most part. And so when we walk around campus, we can just poke and prod a little bit. As I watched Daniel kick the earth at Picnic Point in select areas and say, look at this. This is from a long time ago. And so I think it's just the cultural landscapes, there's just so many layers to it.
Part of the, I guess, difficulty with coming to terms with some cultural landscapes is that over the course of time, and in the case of even the relatively recent phenomenon of the mound builders in the 12,000-year history of occupation of what we call now Wisconsin, is that the original significance or the meaning of these things can get lost or change radically over the course of time?
Yeah, I'll just say I love the term lost when it comes to Native American knowledge or language. And lost is kind of a term that implies, if I just took a little more care, if I were just a little more careful, maybe I wouldn't have lost that. But, you know, Native American knowledge and particularly knowledge as it's carried through language, the United States spent 90 years doing its best to detribalize and eradicate our Native American knowledge bases and languages. It didn't end until I was 5 years old in 1975 with the Indian Self-Determination and Educational Assistance Act. So when I think about, you know, the great interruption of knowledge that happens, that once we began an ethnic cleansing campaign that lasts for 40 years against the Ho-Chunk Nation from 1832 to 1874, you know, we have a great interruption of understanding of the effigy mound landscape, what they represent, what they mean. And with the Ho-Chunk fluent speakers hovering at about 50 fluent speakers today, who has the knowledge that kind of describes and understands the cultural meaning of this landscape in their own language, not having to square peg round hole into another language like English. So when I think about how we understand some of the things like the effigy mounds, and we also have to kind of acknowledge that there's a great interruption that we're only recovering from now. As a Ho-Chunk have this amazing language and cultural revitalization effort underway, and they're still contending with how much to share with us. I'm not Ho-Chunk. I'm a member of the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation. So when I'm going around giving campus tours, it's often like a Spanish person giving Italian history. I'm like, I'm kind of sort of distantly related linguistically to you groups, but I'm not from here. I'm not of the Western Great Lakes. I'm a Plains person. So, but I do really enjoy seeing the healing of the relationship between the Ho-Chunk and the non-Ho-Chunk in the Western Great Lakes. And in this unprecedented era of Indian and non-Indian cooperation, you know, we're just starting to see a lot more sharing happening. And the Ho-Chunk are kind of at the precipice of sharing a whole lot more about how they understand this landscape since they've thrived and hashtag chilled here for so long. And we're only really beginning to know what they know as our relationship heals and they decide to share a little bit more with us.
You know, that is the interesting challenge of trying to figure out how to tell these stories. I think the current controversies are bringing this to the fore. You know, what are the stories we tell about the past? Is it a fixed set of facts, and those facts will remain the same forever, and everyone knows those facts, and they get transmitted through generations in the same way? Well, not so much. History is evolving, and we're reevaluating, and we're picking up new pieces as more information is shared with us. So when I've done tours, and I try and explain as best I can from the information that's been shared with me, what do these places mean? What are these symbols? What are the activities that occurred in these very special, sacred places? I know that I don't have the whole story and may never have the whole story. But that doesn't diminish my sense of awe, my appreciation as a human for what happened, say, on Observatory Hill, where you can stand among these symbols, this grand artwork, this inscription on the landscape that tells us something about how people lived 1,000 years ago, and how we live today. We experience the same kind of thrills, appreciation, awe as we stand on Observatory Hill and look out across the lake. And I can stand there and think, wow, 1,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, there were other humans that were here experiencing virtually the same thing that that I can experience today. That's the power of a cultural landscape.
Although, of course, the landscape that we see today from Observatory Hill, very different from what you would have seen 1,000 years ago and
100 years ago.
Right. Well, that's true. Yes, because even the colonial, to use your term, Aaron, cultural landscape has changed radically in the past 100 years.
Yeah, I mean, Daniel and the university facilities and planning management have begun amazing restoration efforts to deal with invasive species. As the kind of new United States environmental management strategy of this region and citizens of this new colonial project, they said, well, let's just let it get all bushy and grow. and so now we can't really see the lake because it's occluded by a forest barrier. And so if we were here even 100 years ago, the openness would have just been much more clear to us about the bur oak savanna and prairies that used to dominate southern Wisconsin that were not just nature as it was going to play itself out, but again, a massive human intervention of fire ecology and how humans over millennia had shaped southern Wisconsin into this bur oak savanna through repeated lighting of fires for opening for farming space and hunting space and other places. So when I show students pictures of Picnic Point from 1914 and there's just a handful of small trees growing up on it, their minds are blown. And they just can't fathom how open this space used to be just 100 years ago.
You know, that's one of the great myths of European settlement on this continent, that they somehow arrived in a wilderness, unchallenged,
unmanaged.
Unmanaged by humans. Well, guess what? For 12,000 years in this part of the country, humans have been interacting with the landscape, either harvesting trees, burning the prairies, gardening. And so what the Europeans who came to this area saw was something quite distant from an untouched wilderness. It was a human landscape that reflected the lifestyles of the people that were here for thousands and thousands of years. When I say I can stand on Observatory Hill, though, and look out across the lake and imagine, I'm speaking more generically about the topography, about the shoreline, about the size of the lake, and that relationship with water that is such a powerful thing for humans. It's not surprising that the Four Lakes area was a node, a cultural node for this expression, this very unusual expression of effigy mound culture. Nowhere else in the world did people use the earth to express themselves through this iconography, these symbols of things that were important to them. There are burial mounds all across the world, but nowhere else did people use this opportunity to shape the earth to symbolize animals and spirits and celestial bodies.
And they would bring, I'm told, actually different kinds of grass down from, say, farther north in Wisconsin and plant that so that it would stand out. This, you know, effigy would stand out in particular. And as you mentioned, Aaron, with the most of the tree cover, you know, reduced from year to year, you would have all these lines of sight coming down the Yahara River and come to Lake Mendota. Suddenly you can see, you know, all the way across the lake, this, you know, different color effigy mound on the other side.
Yeah, Amy Roseborough, we've been really fortunate that she's finished her PhD here at UW-Madison recently, and she's probably beyond the Ho-Chunk, the person who with the most knowledge about this kind of effigy mound.
I've talked to her
landscape.
Several times.
Mm-hmm. So she's really a treasure for us as a state for someone who's done such wonderful research. And yeah, her studies show that some effigy mounds and mounds, linear and conical, are just, some are built with local soils, but others are built where soil is hauled at a distance, so it kind of has some demarcation on the landscape. And when Daniel was talking about these vistas, when he looks out, I look out a little differently, right? I'm looking out and I'm thinking, okay, did my ancestors ever connect with these people out here?
Mm-hmm.
My ancestors were what we call the marketplace of the Great Plains. We are one of the great trade centers of this hemisphere on the Missouri River. It's Lewis and Clark, there's a reason why they come to us to help them negotiate the rest of the continent, because they know at this trade center there's going to be people from the far west, people from the Gulf Coast, people from the east. It's just an incredible trade center. So when I think about the riverine world, the highways that used to define this continent for us, all these rivers, and I think about the accessibility to here, and I think about, did my ancestors in this vast trade network ever connect to this region in some way? So I'm looking out at the beautiful lake shores. I'm reminding myself of this oak savanna and this openness. I'm looking at the high grounds around me and thinking about these massive earthworks that might be a little more noticeable than they are today. And I'm thinking about the people here and was there any connection to my ancestors in this hemisphere. So for me, it's just a really exciting kind of reflection to think about the vibrant and robust woodland peoples that are here and thinking about my ancestors doing what they do out in the plains and just
was there ever any interaction? And so that's when I think a little bit of the cultural landscapes is just the humanity itself and what kind of interconnectedness is there in some way between the different expressions of humanity in this hemisphere.
We're going to find out about some of the tours that my guests conduct having to do with the cultural landscape of this part of Wisconsin when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Aaron Bird-Bear and Daniel Einstein, and we're looking at the cultural landscape of Wisconsin, and in particular, the UW-Madison, which has a high concentration of this cultural landscape that we're talking about, the Native American landscape for the most part, and then what we might call the colonial landscape on top of that for a relatively short period of time. Now, you two, you give tours of the campus of the UW-Madison, and when you say we give a tour, that sounds fairly, you know, safe and non-controversial, but I gather that it actually can become interesting, let's say, and bring out various points of view, just taking people around campus.
You know, the interesting thing about history, which from my point of view is about telling stories of human significant events, is that it's not a values neutral enterprise. The stories we tell, and who gets to tell the stories, is a function of power. And
history is usually written by the winners.
Often the case. So when we do tours on campus and we talk about some of the commemorative objects, some of the monuments, some of the architectural details that others have chosen as a means of forwarding their narrative, it comes with some baggage. And what's exciting for me is that we have an opportunity with these tours to try and unpack that baggage and provide some broader perspective. Why is it that we celebrate these kinds of things and not other things? And sometimes that's fraught. I think that's clear that it isn't, again, a singular unified vision of what's important.
So take me through one of these tours, you know. Walk me through what are we going to see and where does it become, let's say, difficult to actually summarize what the significance of one of these places is.
Yeah, so I was thinking about Daniel's comments and some of the geographers I know, cartographers, are like, no map is neutral. And, you know, tours are fully communicating the political, social, environmental, and cultural expectations for participating or joining any community. And most of the tours that any university has is what I call a happy meal. Mm-hmm. No complicated feelings. Envision yourself as a happy member of this community. It's all good and everything's benign. And that's not necessarily true. Like every place in the United States, particularly east of the Mississippi River, which is the ethnic cleansing zone or the area of the Indian Removal Act, where just wholesale ethnic cleansing of, you know, 60 indigenous nations are impacted, including here in southern Wisconsin. So on the tour, you know, we're going to watch a journey of an institution and its complicity or just going with the tide of federal Indian policy. And that our tour and luckily our student body in the 1880s, in the early 1900s, have left us these wonderful cultural artifacts that reflect U.S. federal Indian policy and their understanding of their relationship with First Nations in that era. So our tour can start in a few locations, but usually we start in the Memorial Union, 1925, in the heart of coercive assimilation, or the youth incarceration of the boarding school system, where we're trying to detribalize Native Americans and eradicate Native American languages and cultures. So here we have all these First Nations youth in the grinder of assimilation trying to negotiate these institutions that are basically saying that their deficits are their language and culture and they have to be corrected in some way. And that our student body really understood it. And they had this amazing student-created and student-led and amazing event called the Pipe of Peace Ceremony, Friday night before graduation each year from 1891 to 1940. And they staged this elaborate pageant where they created Native American costumes and kind of inhabited Native American persona.
Was this with or without actual Native Americans?
There's one in 1923 that Ho-Chunk Nation citizen Oliver Lemire participates with his son. That's the one time I think we know that there's, but the others are not. Uh-huh. And I actually have a 1921. The students are dressed up in Native American costumes. Sometimes they have feathers on their heads. Sometimes they have blankets. Sometimes they have more elaborate costumes. Sometimes they're wearing wigs of long hair. So they're just fully going all in on this Native American pageant idea. And it says this. Brothers of the tribe of 1921, and to the tribesmen of 1922, to the squaws and the old men and the elders and the papooses, the mighty warriors of the illustrious tribe of 1921 with the squaws are about to depart to the great unknown world that lies beyond the lapping waters of the Four Lakes. And they just speak about kind of their affiliation to the university and transferring kind of leadership to the next class and healing a bit of the violence that they enacted toward each other, because hazing was thought as the way to unify a class. And so there was a lot of student violence in the 1880s and early 1900s. And eventually hazing is banned at the university in the 1920s. So this Pipe of Peace is a symbolic healing of them. They kind of borrow Native American traditions. But the Memorial Union is now emblazoned with all this Native American imagery,
right?
Because it's built in the heart of the Pipe of Peace's popularity in the student body. But the irony of it all is that here's these non-Indigenous people, these non-First Nations people, pretending and dressing up to be Native American and enacting Native American culture, while at the same time, you know, Native American youth of the state are incarcerated in a youth incarceration system trying to eradicate their cultures and languages, right? So, it's, you know, white students can pretend to be Indian, but Indians can't be Indian, right? And so it's just this great moment of capturing coercive assimilation and our students' probably assumption that these are going to be cultures of the past, that these cultures won't be transmitted forward. And in some way, we're remembering and honoring a people of the past. So we kind of start, you know, our tours are not necessarily chronologically ordered because the building and the pathways are not necessarily created chronologically. So we jump around time a little bit. But we often begin in the 1920s when the Union goes up and the Pipe of Peace of popularity is so popular. And it gets just to reflect upon, what is our relationship with First Nations? How do we understand them? How do we understand our representations of them if we choose to try to represent Native Americans in some way? And why would we choose to represent them in this way? Why not more accurate? Why are we doing these broad stereotypes? Why do we care about accuracy and authenticity in any way? Or is just a broad brushstroke a stereotype enough? And so why would we do that? So I think it's just really exciting for us to ask our students, if you wanted to stage some sort of public display of your understanding of your relationship with Native Americans, would you choose to do the Pipe of Peace again today and say things as they were saying, or would you choose to do something different? And if it was different, what would it be?
You know, we have this conversation going on in the country about the importance of certain monuments, and I think it's critical to look at these places, these objects, in the context of how we interact with them today. Do we see them as an opportunity to have a conversation about how people thought before us? Or is it a place of worship and idolatry where we can reaffirm something about our values? Those are two very different things. So when I see the Pipe of Peace, which is now the logo or the emblematic of the friendship the camaraderie that is expressed in this place we call the Union. I see it as an opportunity to have that conversation about what does it mean to come together and to have that conversation. It's not necessarily an object that glorifies this process of assimilation that clearly is a painful part of American past.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm a Badger. You know, I'm a proud Badger alumni. I love our institution. And the things that we see reflected are just what's happening everywhere. The Pipe of Peace is not unique to here. There are Pipe of Pieces at Dartmouth. There are Pipe of Pieces at many universities. So the early 1900s is when we have mascots and Pipe of Peace kind of ceremonies emerge as you're kind of ethnically cleansing and interning Native Americans in internment camps called reservations. You know it's a prison system because we have the spy word, oh, that spy's gone off the reservation. And that's a bad thing. So you know reservations are a prison system if you can't go off them. So, you know, as Native Americans are interred and we're in this process, you know, it's just every building built in these eras reflect in some way, you know, this kind of federal Indian policy. And our institution is just no special or no different. It's really reflecting what's happening on this continent in terms of federal Indian policy at that moment of time. And it's pretty much baked into so many buildings, and that's what's exciting about the tour.
Monuments. Now, there are various monuments with various inscriptions, as there are throughout the country. Is the monument itself then a piece of history that is worth preserving, you know, the way people thought at a certain point in time? Or should that monument, you know, give way to more contemporary thinking?
I think each monument probably has its own reason for being there. So when I think about some of the monuments that are being challenged in the southern states, and they weren't really immediately put up after the Civil War.
No, more like 50 or 60 years later.
More of a manifestation of white supremacy and Jim Crow. So they're not as historical as people would like them to be or why they became what they are. But I think about just one representation. It's not a monument, but it's a mural. And in the Memorial Union that we were talking about just earlier, there's a wonderful mural on the ceiling of the main lounge foyer. And it's of Native Americans, but it's not very accurate or authentic. They're very stereotypical representations. And when the Union was under renovation, they asked a few of us what they should do about these. And I said, please keep them. Despite their inaccuracy, despite their stereotypical nature, it reminds us of how far we've grown. So it's important for us, for some monuments that aren't celebrating necessarily white supremacy, but more reflecting our understanding of each other in that moment of time, that I think those are valuable to keep. That it shows you can't really see how you've grown unless you have something to kind of measure it to. And I think the monuments that are really valuable for us on campus are like the Black Hawk marker of 1888. That kind of shows how students understood the contested history of this hemisphere. And they're reflecting some of the Indian wars that happened here in the Western Great Lakes. And I think that's a powerful marker, although the only verbs on it are called retreated and pursued. And I tell students, are those honorific terms? Are those terms of honor?
Well, except that at least the interpretations I've heard of retreated in that context of the Black Hawk War was that it was a brilliant retreat, making the most and then some of very limited options.
Yeah, just as George Washington did a brilliant tactical retreat across Manhattan Island and Brooklyn and whatnot, right? Mm-hmm. So, but ultimately, it's the student body in this 1888 marker. Just want to remind us there was a contest for this space.
What does that marker exactly say? I mean, it does just that Black Hawk and his people retreated through here.
It says Black Hawk, Sauk Chief, retreated through these grounds July 21st, 1832. Pursued by militia and U.S. regulars, placed by the class of 1888, June 17th, 1913. So 25 years after they graduate, the class of 1888 gives us this gift.
The interesting thing about so many interpretive plaques is that with the passing of time and a reexamination of the facts as we understand them today. The fact that we have this plaque talking about Black Hawk crossing the campus kind of reifies an event, which we now think probably didn't happen. And I always find it interesting how a commemorative object sometimes takes on a life of its own. It becomes history as opposed to an opportunity to reflect or represent an event.
Right.
That monument talks about Black Hawk climbing, essentially, Bascom Hill on his way out to Pleasant Branch in Middleton. Well, if you have a good understanding of the trails that were established at the time in the presence of a marshland, a wetland, you know that a beleaguered and starving group of people being pursued by the militia are not going to want to climb Bascom Hill. They're going to want to take the flat ground. They're going to want to make as much progress as they can. It was convenient, I think, for the people who made that plaque to put it in a high place, because we put plaques in high places.
And, where people can see them.
Where people can see them. So does it reflect really what happened? Is it a good expression or an accurate expression of what was really happening? Or is it infused with fabrication? And again, this...
Or even just romanticizing.
Romanticized or values that reflect the people who compose these signs, which is, you know, part of this ongoing conversation that Aaron and I have been having for years now about how to do a better job of interpreting the events and the effigy mound culture that we have here on campus. Whose voice is the one that is allowed to frame these issues and to identify the important pieces of the story?
Well, in the case of the mounds, it's an interesting question because, of course, they were put there by Native Americans, but Native Americans that were how closely connected to Native Americans today? You say, Aaron, that the narrative, the story of those mounds is essentially, except for a short period of time, unbroken. And so that if Native Americans were to interpret the mounds, that would be definitive?
I would say that we have two First Nations here in the Western Great Lakes whose origin stories place them here. The Ho-Chunk, Mogoshutes, the Red Banks, their first village, the Menominee, the ancient ones who've been here for 10,000 plus years. Gary Bisaw, the president of the Menominee Nation, when he spoke with the chancellor at the 2015 summit between the Native Nation civic leaders and the university leaders, simply stood up and said, "Chancellor Blank, we've been here 12,000 years. We plan to be here 12,000 more." And with the Ho-Chunk asserting their place here for time immemorial, I've seen one of our Ho-Chunk faculty give a presentation on campus, a public lecture in our museum, and he simply said, "The anthropologists can say whatever we want, or whatever they want. Well, we built them." So the Ho-Chunk assert through their oral histories, through their language, and, you know, they're like, "We have words for animals that are no longer here. You know, we have words for the saber-toothed tiger. We got words for these megafauna that used to live here." And so they just kind of talk about their depth of humanity in place, and they do assert cultural continuance. And believe it or not, the Ready Mix legal case that happened here in Madison, where a concrete company wanted to dig up conical and possibly, I'm not sure if they're linear mounds, but that were on their property for the material underneath them. And that since some conical, linear, and effigy mounds don't seem to have physical human remains, most do, but some do not, the concrete company said, since they can't be proven to be burial sites until you dig into them, we don't have the technology yet to really see in them as well as we'd like, that they should be able to dig them up because they can't be conclusively proven to be burial sites. And the judge's decision, which happened only like 3 weeks ago, said that the Ho-Chunk's cultural, historic, and religious affiliation with the Effigy Mound culture is such that despite our ability through Western science and Western research, meaning Western, not of this hemisphere. I'm not sure how West is not of this hemisphere, but it is. And that despite our academia research not having the anthropological evidence to show direct continuance of kind of human occupation of the Ho-Chunk in connecting them to the woodland societies, in the body of U.S. law, they're connected through religious, historic, and cultural affiliation with them. So U.S. law said it's irrelevant trying to trace this kind of direct kinship mm-hmm. from the Ho-Chunk to the woodland, that they have become one with the Effigy Mound landscape over time, regardless of how our research wants to establish kinship. And the Ho-Chunk themselves, through their oral histories and stories, assert their place here for time immemorial. So I think that kind of, we said, informs some of the understanding of the Ho-Chunk's asserting our Western research maybe not connecting the dots as tightly as we like. It seems likely, right? That's all I see now in academia. It seems likely that they're their descendants. It seems to make the most sense, kind of like Occam's razor.
Mm-hmm. Simplest solution.
Simplest solution is likely. You know, mm-hmm. you have Iowa, the Oto, the Ho-Chunk. I forgot, maybe I'm getting the finer details wrong there. But in terms of understanding their understanding, you know, they do assert, and we're getting to the point of our research getting closer to their oral histories.
And this is a nice opportunity to reflect on how our understanding of the mounds and the relationship of the people who built those mounds has evolved. When European Americans first settled in this area, the antiquarians, as they like to call themselves, forwarded all sorts of, well, what we would say are bizarre ideas about who could
lost,
have built
lost tribes and that
the
kind
lost
of thing.
Tribes of Israel. Mm-hmm. They took a wrong turn and somehow managed
should have
to,
stopped and asked for directions.
Yeah, they were responsible, or perhaps it was the Aztecs that a people from the south made their way up to this area, and they were responsible, but. These antiquarians and their hypotheses about who could have built these places were impeded by their prejudice, by their bias. The people that were here at the time, in their view, could not have possibly developed the social cohesiveness or the engineering skills to create these places. So they came up with all sorts of other ideas. And it was only relatively recently that within the community of anthropologists that there's universal acceptance that these places are a reflection of native people, the people that have always been here. So there's a perfect case to be made for how the stories we tell about the past can evolve. We can do better at understanding what human events mean.
A few more thoughts about the cultural landscape of Wisconsin and the UW campus in particular when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Aaron Birdbear and Daniel Einstein, and we're looking at the cultural landscape of this part of Wisconsin, University of Wisconsin campus in particular, since it's so rich in that sort of cultural landscape. Well, we've been talking about the mounds, the effigy mounds in particular, and adding interpretive language so that those who visit the mounds can have some insight into them. But what if those who know most about the mounds, which would be the tribes, don't want to share that information?
Yeah, that's a really wonderful part about this 21st century, is that the knowledge and innovation we're doing with First Nations is unprecedented in the history of our country. We're in a new era of First Nation and non-First Nation cooperation and collaboration and innovation. So what's amazing about some Native nations like the Dene Nation and the Ho-Chunk Nation and other nations is that they just have simple cultural protocols about who can know what information, who can share what information, what time of year you can share that information. Some informations like the story of Wongshikomic, or what the Ho-Chunk call Lake Mendota. That story is only supposed to be told in the winter when there's snow on the ground. So the story of where the man lies and how Lake Mendota is known to the Ho-Chunk as Wongshikomikla. Wongshikomikla is a who can say it, when you can say it, who you can say it to. All those cultural protocols become in operation. And similarly, you know, the information about the Effigy Mound landscape and what they represent also tests the boundaries of sharing and the limits of their cultural protocols of who they can share that with, when they can share it with, and who within their nation can share it. So there's just a lot of culture and action around understanding the mounds. And we're just in the 21st century at a point where the Ho-Chunk are really on the cusp of sharing a lot more with us. And it's just a super exciting time.
So there will be more forthcoming as what, the healing continues?
Correct. I always remind people that, you know, I'm non-Ho-Chunk. And so I try my best not to, you know, explain their culture in any way, because it's going to be a funhouse mirror and I'm going to mess it up somehow.
And there are things I gather than they're withholding from you.
That is correct. That is correct. I watch Ho-Chunk cultural protocols in action as they hit a topic area and they're like, okay, we got to talk around this because there's some non-Ho-Chunk here. And I watch it all the time at the Senate Bill 60 rally when they're really explaining their connection to this cultural and effigy mound landscape. And I could see them hitting the limits of what they felt they could share with non-Ho-Chunk. So it really is a binary. You're either Ho-Chunk or you're not Ho-Chunk. And their cultural protocols kind of stipulate what information can be shared with non-Ho-Chunk.
But that said, there's still opportunities for us to do a better job of helping people appreciate just how special these sites are and appeal to universal human expressions that don't violate any special cultural knowledge. Folks are really interested in understanding these places and finding ways to understand meaning, and we can do that. And the university is engaged in a project now to develop additional interpretive signage for campus, including a sign that will address some of the concerns raised by students in the last couple of years, having to do with Native Nation sovereignty, which is a concept that's still very confusing to the general population. How is it that we have a nation alongside the U.S. government?
Well, I mean, that's been a question that's gone on for a very long time.
Right. So there will be an opportunity to in very limited text, tackle that challenging idea of Native Nation sovereignty. I did want to just make sure that we put some of this mound culture on campus in a context. And one way to think about the richness of these cultural attributes, on the UW-Madison campus, we can today see 35 effigy and other burial mounds, which occur in places like Observatory Hill, Picnic Point, Eagle Heights, and out at the Arboretum. It also must be said that the university has been complicit in the loss, or at least the inability to see the above-ground features associated with mounds. Mounds have both an above-ground and a below-ground component. So I always take exception when people say the mounds were destroyed. We may not know where those mounds were. We may not know what exists below grade. But it should be remembered that in earlier years, university officials allowed construction to occur on places where these mounds once existed. So Bascom Hall, North Hall, Agricultural Hall are all places where mounds formerly were located. We've not respected these places in the past, and the university, I think, is making great strides to protect and share these places so that we can understand them in today's context, but also make sure that these places survive into the future.
And that's the beauty of the tour, right? So, you know, we look at North Hall and Bascom Hall and we say, Indian Wars, that's when these are built. And you're building and kind of erasing the society that was here before you. So the colonial veneer starts being paved over the depth of humanity that was here prior to the arrival of humans from other continents. But then when you go to Observatory Hill and these amazing monuments that are still there, the double-tailed water spirit and the Thunderbird effigy, the bird effigy that's there, now it's a nationally registered historic monument, and that we've elevated it to the same importance as North Hall, the first building of our university campus. So I love the story and the arc of the tour is that it shows the hope of a shared future together, that here we are. We might not fully understand as non-Ho-Chunk what these cultural artifacts represent to us today, but we hope to learn about them in the future, and we're doing our best to protect and preserve them for generations following us to know them. So the hopeful arc of the tour shows Indian Wars, the Black Hawk marker, that great imperialist nostalgia. It should read, Roaring Thunder, Ho-Chunk persisted and remained in his ancestors' homeland despite 40 years of attempting to remove the Ho-Chunk, you know, placed by the class of 1888, right? I mean, if we told the story of our place instead of people that kind of overlap in this space to some degree. So the tour is so hopeful in that we look at the complexity of white supremacy in the 1920s, we look at ethnic cleansing, we look at Indian Wars, but then we arrive here today and this shared future and stewardship of this ancient landscape in ways that we can hopefully continue to learn together as we go forward.
Are these tours for just anybody, or do you have to be an incoming student? And in either event, how do you connect to one?
By appointment. We work mostly with classes and programs on campus, so graduate students, undergraduate students, and K-12 students out in the school districts around us who can make the time to do a field trip. So we have versions of the tour for third and fourth graders. We've done preschool students. I love the fourth graders. They ask the hardest questions because they're not afraid of their question being judged by their peers. So they ask what they want to know. And it's just a wonderful way for students to learn about the depth of humanity here. And then who are the contemporary American Indian nations today? What are their lives like? What do they care about? What are they going to become in the future? And Dayjobe Residence Hall, or Four Lakes in the Ho-Chunk Nation, features some really great contemporary expressions of Native American culture today, of the modern Indian nations that are such wonderful and powerful nations here in the Western Great Lakes.
One source of information that people may want to explore can be found on the website of the Lakeshore Nature Preserve, where a number of these mounds are located. And from there, there are many other sources.
Well, Daniel Einstein and Aaron Birdbear, thanks for enlightening us about this fascinating and ongoing story of the cultural landscape in this part of Wisconsin.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland. I hope you can join me next time around for University of the Year.